Okay, bonjour Sébastien.
Bonjour Horst.
Can you talk with me about who you are and what you do?
So I'm a PhD student in cognitive science and sociology in Berlin. Well, part-time in Berlin and part-time in Paris.
Okay, you're French.
I'm French.
Yeah.
And what I work on is the evolution of information on blogs. So how our cognitive biases influence how we transform information when we copy it from blog to blog.
And blog to blog, a blog, a web
blog? A web blog, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But your whole scientific area sounds very biologic for me.
Well, cognitive science is a great mix of many disciplines. In fact, it's all the disciplines that work on the brain. Mm-hmm. So there are linguistics, there are mathematical models of neural networks. There is biology of the neuron and the brain generally. There is cognitive psychology.
Mm-hmm. But you also cover media and art.
Mostly text.
Text
mining.
And if I understand you correctly, you research what happens with information if it wanders from brain to block and from block to block and from block to brain.
Exactly. Exactly it. It's the idea that from blog to brain, there's a transformation in the brain, and then from brain to blog, there's a new transformation.
Okay.
And
you have a control group in Africa without electricity who just use talking or writing or drumming?
No. I don't yet. It would be nice, though.
Okay. Good. Okay. So that's your research.
Yes.
Information loss or information gain in information transport.
Yeah, it's the general framework is this idea of we have mental representations that we keep producing as public representations, and there's a kind of epidemiology of representations where we interpret public representations, produce new ones, and they spread throughout society, and some of them are transformed a lot each time they go through our brains, and some of them spread a lot throughout society and become cultural, and that's what characterizes society.
Okay.
So this is a guy called Dan Sperber, who's an anthropologist, who wrote about that about 20 years ago. And there's been a lot of theory about that and theory developments, but not many empirical studies on does it really describe reality.
And is it a difference if some idea from a mind is published in a blog or in vice versa published in a newspaper article, or is it the same for your research?
There is. Well, the main difference I see is that there's a difference in authority. So
in?
Authority in the author. So there people might behave differently because they are taking information from a newspaper rather than from a blog.
Ah, okay. Blog is more direct and less serious, so to speak.
Yeah, but it's not clear what the effect would be.
Okay, okay. And so you research specifically information from blogs, from the blogosphere to the
mind. Well, the data I had access to was news outlets and blogs. So it was
okay. Can you explain what a news outlet is? Because
like online newspapers.
Ah, okay. Ah, okay, which is on the web, but maybe more serious than a blog from myself.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So well, I had.
That sounds interesting. So you don't get paid for it, I assume.
I do.
So you get paid for reading blogs and writing about them. Wow.
Well, I don't really read the blogs. Got a nice place.
Can you make a self loop where with two people
I write the blog and I read
and
myself
I get paid for researching your blog and write about it and we milk our government for taxpayers' money.
We could try that.
Okay.
Wouldn't be very fun.
No, please continue.
So the data I had access to was there's a group of researchers in the US who have scanned 1 million sources online, so newspapers and blogs. So 1 million sources for about 9 months, and they extracted from that all the quotes. So everything that was in quotation marks. And so what you get from that is a very long list of quotes with URLs and timestamps.
Yeah.
So publication date. And what they saw was that those quotes, in fact, which shouldn't change when they're copied from blog to blog.
They were alive and evolutionary.
They do, exactly.
Wow.
So quite often, in fact, they change a little bit. So, well, people crop the quotes. That's normal to fit it in your sentence. But quite often there are words that disappear, contractions that appear, disappear, words that are replaced sometimes. And so what I looked at was, I got that data because they published it. And what I looked at was when a word is replaced by a new word specifically, and what's so specific about the word that disappears and the word that appears. And what happens is, you can say many things on words, and it's not very clear what is the main effect, but some of the things we found is that usually words that we learn later, like around 15 years old, that we learn later in development, disappear and are replaced by words that we learn earlier in development.
So words that are more easy or more common to a simple childish mind.
But it's also words that are generally more frequent in the environment.
So the quotes get dumped down to a more natural language. And the most interesting question that I have now, and the meaning of the quotes change? So are the quotes manipulated to lead more in the direction of the author who quoting, so to his agenda?
I think what I've looked at can't capture that.
Okay.
Because it's only one word being replaced. And for one, it's only one word being replaced, and for two, I don't have the tools to automatically really detect that the meaning has really fundamentally changed.
So you make more linguistic.
I'd like to go towards that. That's the plan.
So can I take from that if my blogs who had exactly two readers, me myself and my girlfriend, if I force her to read it, if I use quotes, more scientific robots will read it. And more people like you will put their brain power into reading my blog.
I think it would be scanned anyway. If you're linked towards by even only one other blog, it would probably
Does
be
that include Facebook posts or so? So should I use quotes everywhere?
Facebook, they're also doing that kind of research with their own data, which they don't publish, but... It would include Facebook posts if you were in France, because another group we're working with have developed an a Facebook app, which is basically, it's called the Algopol app, which you can Google and find. It's a research app that lets users basically share a large part of their data with a research group to see the evolution of their social network. And how their interactions evolved through time with their friends, etc., depending on their posts. And in return, the users get a very nice visualization of how their own social network has evolved since they joined Facebook. So they have a visual view of their groups of friends and what happened when new friends appeared in their social network and how that connected people together and new groups formed depending on their period of life. And all that. So you can browse kind of the evolution of your social network.
But this is another research.
What I'm working on, but it's data that I might have access to. So it's also Facebook posts.
Okay, Sebastian, part two. Scientific blog. Block science research. Okay.
Open science.
I find it so funny that useless blogs get subject to research.
Well, they're not useless. They're productions from people. So.
exactly. Okay. So, and you researching the replacement of words in quotes in blogs.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was. Do you want me to go on that or?
I want to lead toward science and software. But
what I discovered, in fact, in my everyday work, it was when I started 2 years ago now, is that many papers are published in this field. This field mainly involves a lot of text mining, so techniques to extract information from unstructured text, so from blogs.
So we talk about little scripts or web crawlers here.
Yeah, so there's the crawling, there's the analysis of trying to find keywords in the text, trying to find grammatical structure in the text, which is transformed, or stuff like that. But since it's natural language in real life, it's not clean as a computer would like it to be.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of heuristics and techniques, like trying to limit to find the root of a word. When you find a word in the text, you try to find the root of the word and encode that information.
So you try to be tolerant to spelling errors,
yes,
or encoding,
yeah,
errors, or
exactly,
page line breaks or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that leads to kind of you're it's like as if you were cooking, in fact, with,
mm-hmm,
you have small recipes that you put in and see how it works. And well, I mean, all science works like that. But the thing is that many papers are published in this field and not much details on all this kitchen work.
So how the web crawler was programmed to,
yeah,
gather the data.
Yeah, yeah. How that was programmed, how the texts were processed, how the network was clustered, with which parameters, which algorithm exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing which has been really a difficulty for me, because I had to learn from scratch all the techniques and how you combine them together, and I don't
even
know.
You was no coder before?
I was a coder,
yes.
But it's a whole area of,
mm-hmm,
coding that,
okay,
most people aren't familiar with.
Okay.
And
so for your research, you was forced to code some little callers or programs?
A lot of program.
A lot of programs.
Yeah, that's mainly what I do.
And every student in your field does that, or are there specialists who do that for others? Is there a department hacker for that?
It depends on the laboratories, and it,
mm-hmm,
depends on the field of research. So mainly all cognitive psychology people usually have research engineers who do,
mm-hmm,
the
okay,
experiment development for them, but not always. A lot of researchers do a lot of programming.
Mm-hmm.
And in my field, we usually do the programming ourselves, because,
mm-hmm,
it's also tailored to our needs, and
okay,
it's hard,
yeah,
to explain. I mean, the research is the coding, in,
yeah,
fact. The act of doing the research. And so that's, in fact, the knot of what I felt was a problem, because you come across these papers which...
We're talking scientific journals,
yes,
here.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah,
research published,
is published, peer-reviewed,
okay, yes,
papers. That explain an idea in some level of detail, but not enough to be able to reproduce.
Like your idea, so keywords in quotes got changed over,
yes,
time.
Yes, and I would explain what,
yeah,
kind,
yeah,
of details I looked at on the words,
mm-hmm,
what kind of features.
And then you will say, my result is that over 1 year, 5% of words of a quote,
yeah,
got changed.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
you will, if I got your point straight,
yeah,
For really reproduce these results, you would need full access to the source code of all the programs and,
yeah,
helpers and web,
yeah,
crawlers you did for that research.
Yeah, exactly.
Because without them, it's not really reproducible.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So there's two sides to that. The first one is, well, there's maybe three sides even. The first one is you can't really reproduce easily that research. The second one, so that's a problem in
science ethics.
You have to rewrite the whole code yourself.
Yeah.
Or you have to email the people and try and get the code.
Okay.
The second point is, since that code isn't published, very likely it's not well organized and not well documented.
And maybe not stored at all, and the department get lost or
lose it or something.
People die. Or move.
And it stays on the hard drive of the student who wrote it, and,
yeah,
he leaves and that,
yeah,
goes,
yeah,
away.
So it really disappears.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problem with that is that even in 2 years' time, the lab who wrote that code, if it's not documented and not well organized, even they won't be able to reread it and rerun it. And so some versions of the software, the libraries they used will have changed,
yeah,
and it won't work anymore.
Okay,
it's bit
okay.
rot. So it's not living code.
It's dead code.
It's dead code.
Not maintained code,
yes,
not usable.
Yeah, and not even documented.
I can think if... I have troubles finding my own code from 2 years back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and would not know how to use it anymore.
And so that's a big problem, because it's a net null gain for everybody.
Yeah.
Like, for the research community, you only get to read the paper with few details and impossible to reproduce. And even from the lab's perspective, you're writing a paper and producing code that you won't be able to reuse later on.
And you think so this is against the quality of science alone, because it makes it first you don't have access to the code mm-hmm. that you need to reproduce the research mm-hmm. and research on that mm-hmm. topic, and secondly the code itself get lost even yes. if you have connections yes. to yeah. get a load to the code
exactly.
so
yeah.
okay because it's not maintained code
yeah. Yeah.
okay sorry
I no battery so I can't remember
Sebastian Patrou 3 with new batteries in the phone, buyed by a very sexist Belgian vendor of batteries and computer science student. Okay, Sebastian. where did we stop?
In publishing code.
Yes,
for
you buy. Yeah, and the code is not published together with the science,
yes.
so it's basically useless
yes.
for you.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's useless for me. It's useless for reproducibility
yep.
reasons. It's useless for the lab who produces it. And the last point is, there's two last points. The third point is, you don't know if people made mistakes in their code, since a lot of the research is mainly code. If there is just one little
yep.
mistake, which could be there, and which often can be there,
mm-hmm.
You don't know if there is one. There's no code review. So there's
so a faulty code could produce faulty research.
Yes, but in all good faith. It's not necessarily people trying to falsify results, but it's just you can't inspect the code.
So you could not verify the
yes.
research without
yes.
having the code.
Yes.
Okay.
And like as a personal experience, one thing I had with that was I was coding for about, I don't know, 3-4 months, and on the fifth month, I discovered a bug that I had introduced in the second month.
In your own code.
In my own code.
Yes.
And I discovered another one like 2 weeks ago
mm-hmm.
that changed a bit of the results.
Yep.
And if I don't I plan to publish my code to have it verified.
Yeah.
But if I don't do that, I have no protection against
your own mistakes.
My own mistakes
yeah,
in
yeah.
my code. And the last point is that in this field, there are many actors, and some of the actors are very large companies like Google and Facebook, who are also working a lot on text mining and their own research in
mm-hmm.
Social networks. And they generally have a lot more manpower for coding,
mm-hmm.
A lot more resources, and a lot more data.
Mm-hmm.
So if, as researchers, we are trying not to publish any code, any usable, reusable tools, it's completely counterproductive, and I think research will become obsolete very fast if it doesn't adapt to a free software, open source community model
mm-hmm.
where code is shared, is made to be usable easily, and when you publish a paper at I don't know, half of the added value is also a tool that you publish with the paper,
mm-hmm.
which is the tool you used to build all the analysis in the paper. Not doing that means everybody, it's teams of 2, 3, 4, or 5 people compared to teams, I don't know how
mm-hmm.
many people there are.
So your point is, if you publish scientific research, it is important to also publish the code.
Yes.
And the practice, as you see it, at least in your field of study, is not so.
It's not normal to publish code, and it's surprising. In fact, it's a whole different mindset. For example, I started my PhD not long ago. Maybe half of my time has been spent making code cleaner and
mm-hmm.
documenting it and making
okay.
it easier to install and reproduce what I
so
have done.
So basically you invest your time in your code and the code produce the research.
Exactly, yes. And
you're not reading newspaper articles or blogs yourself, so to speak.
No.
You have a code,
yes.
you program a
that reads the,
that.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly. And a lot of my time on coding
mm-hmm.
is spent on making it readable and making it well organized
mm-hmm.
and documenting it properly so it can be reused. And the general feeling I have sometimes is as if...
Merci, monsieur.
Sorry. The feeling I have sometimes is as if I'm wasting my time, because it's not a subject that is talked about. It's not a recognized activity in the research.
Maybe you touched a
field.
Taboo, something nobody speaks of, but everybody knows.
Anybody knows, but
unwritten law of how to behave.
Yes, it's maybe a bit of that, but I don't think it's again. It's good faith from the researchers, because when I talk about it around me, a lot of them say, "Well, the truth of the matter is, if you publish your code, you get bombarded with user requests of how can I do this, how can I do that, how can I do this, how can I do that." So the first time I came across that argument, I was kind of convinced, because you don't have time to do everything. Then thinking about it a bit more, it's like if you do an analogy with a writer, it's as if a writer was telling you, oh,
an author,
for a book.
He don't want feedback.
I wrote a book, and oh, it's horrible.
It's
read only. It's horrible, and receiving tons of fan mail.
Yeah.
I created a whole fan fiction community, a fandom, and it's terrible because they're all wanting new stories, etc., etc.
They should only buy it and read it, or
exactly.
Maybe only buy it. But
so
no,
you
no,
see
no.
The contradiction in and.
But I see another thing. My scientific knowledge is not very good, but I learned that for doing science, in contrast to doing secret alchemy stuff, science has to be reproducible, verifiable, and something
falsifiable.
Else. Falsifiable.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the proper principles.
Yeah, and if you don't have that, you basically have no science. So I think what you tell me is that with the act of not publishing the code because it's too irritating or too troublesome, basically they're doing not science.
Well, what people argue in that case is that in the long term, if anything really deeply wrong is published, in the long term it will be found out that it's wrong. Because people will try eventually to reproduce it.
But
this
reproducer has to do the code in his own again. And then nobody can say if it's the same code and if he produced the same result.
And so, all in all, it slows everything down a lot.
So you're hindering science,
say. Absolutely.
By doing
no
proper science.
Now, the reason for all that, because, I mean, scientists aren't just stupid people who don't want to publish their code. If they don't publish their code, it's also because they're not paid for it. They're not incentivized to publish their code at all. The main currency in researcher world is the number of peer-reviewed papers you have published and the journals in which they were published. So if you publish
the scientific
journals. So if you publish in a very high-profile scientific journal like Nature or Science, or that's like the best.
It's a career boost.
It's a huge career boost. And if you have three papers in such papers, they count as, I don't know, 5-6 papers in other journals. So there's this measure which is called impact factor, which measures
how often your study get quoted in other journals and so on.
Exactly. And so the main problem with this is that only papers, scientific papers, are counted, and code isn't, for example, included as a publication. It isn't counted in.
Because it's not a topic of scientific papers normally.
Yes, exactly.
So it is out of the whole peer review system.
Exactly, absolutely. It's out of band, yes. So it's work that isn't valued, and naturally, in an already very competitive field, people don't spend a lot of time doing work that isn't valued and
because
that won't help their career.
Because it will not push their career in
yes,
any way.
Yes, absolutely.
And how big is the Schnittmenge, how many of the scientists in your field are also activists of free software, or at least contributors to open source projects? So they have at least, if not from science, they have the idea that sharing code is a good thing from their open source connections. Is this a very rare thing to be, if you're a coder or if you're a researcher in your field, to also know about open source?
Many researchers who do a lot of code are open source friendly.
Yeah.
Most of them, because you write code in generally open source languages, but they're not open source activists.
Yeah, but they're users of open source, end users.
Yes,
definitely.
Mm-hmm. And they agree with many of the principles, and people who really do, computer science related code with linguistics are really very open source friendly and have published tools also, but it's not
But they publish them on GitHub on behalf of their open source community, not of their on behalf of their open science community.
Yes, but that, right? I mean that can happen on a code project.
Yeah.
Like you will get funding for producing a tool, and in that case, it's normal to publish the tool for them, to publish the code.
No, I mean for researchers like you who write their own code to create their research or to help organize their research.
Yes.
And then it's not standard practice to also publish the code.
Yeah. Even though it will be standard practice if it is a project which goal is to produce a tool. So you have projects to understand things and projects to produce tools.
Mm-hmm.
And if the project is to produce tool, it will seem normal to everybody to publish the code.
Yeah.
But if the project is to understand something, it will seem completely preposterous to everybody to spend time producing a tool and publish the tool.
So like it is necessary that if you research, if you do your research for, let's say, a quote, disappearing words,
mm-hmm.
that you eat breakfast, but you will not come on the idea to publish your breakfast integrals.
Yes.
So
yes.
Okay.
Where were we?
Yeah, at this argument that the scientists do not publish the code of the tools they used to generate science.
Yes, exactly. And that, I think there is a quite wide community, not only open source friendly, but open source activist, in the sense that, well, not necessarily activists, but active contributors in what I have seen. And what I know is the Python community, which is really getting very big, because it is the main language used in bioinformatics, in astrophysics, trying to detect with machine learning new stars, new galaxies, and images from telescopes.
I think Python is very scientist friendly for not computer scientists.
So yes.
Who need a bit of coding but don't want to spend their lifetime doing it. They have other plans too.
Yeah, absolutely. But even for people who do a lot of mainly coding, in fact, there's a very big community around tools like the Interactive Python Notebook, which has received a lot of funding, I think, at Berkeley for 2 years of development full time. And so there is a huge community around that, and there is also initiatives like, well, there are many initiatives, Hack Your PhD, the Mozilla Science Lab, who are testing code reviews with scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So they are promoting the fact that scientists should not only do peer review of their papers, but peer review of their code, and they're working with software engineers that are peer reviewing the code of researchers. Which is a very interesting initiative, and the whole goal is to try and shift the practices and the mindset and the whole culture around code and generally open. It's the many facets of open science. So there's open access, which pretty much has won now. Most researchers are very.
Can you just to clarify? Open access means I, as a non-scientist consumer, can have access to the paper you wrote with my tax money
freely.
Yeah. And so I have not to pay a DRM.
Yes, exactly. System, but even as a researcher, usually, when you work in an institution, the institution pays a subscription to scientific journals so that you can have access to the papers published in those journals.
But only you as a member of the university, not the public.
Yes. And so but there's two points. There's the fact that the public can't read those papers, won't start paying 20, 30 euro per paper. And the second thing
is if the scientist research who created the articles and the papers is taxpayer money.
Yes.
But some private owned scientific journals later own it.
Yes.
I mean, that's so offending.
And yes.
I wonder that it's normal.
Yes, it's crazy. And the second thing is that it costs millions to universities also.
These full subscriptions of.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But there is also the initiative of having the peer-reviewed journals completely transferred in the internet and organized by scientists themselves.
Also.
Are you in touch with this movement, or it's another topic now?
So I haven't been talking really with that movement.
Yep.
It's something I'm really interested in, because I think models like Stack Overflow, all the Stack Exchange series of sites, or Reddit, or Slashdot,
which are de facto private-owned companies.
Which are, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
even Reddit is a private-owned company, but
absolutely.
At least the content is usually Creative Commons license, and you can read.
And the code is free software.
Yeah.
And building a kind of online peer review system based on those ideas, basically, that your publications get voted up or down by experts in your field. Their votes depend on their expertise, which is itself measured by their own karma or whatever measure you have. And also the other important fact is that reviews themselves of the papers, which would be the equivalent of comments in Reddit or Slashdot, which for now usually aren't published. So there is.
So if I produce an article in Nature, so the best of what I can do, and they say it's peer reviewed, then I don't know how many.
So you get the reviews.
Yes.
But the community doesn't get the reviews.
So I, as a consumer, read, this article of Sebastian is in Nature and is peer reviewed. Mm-hmm. It would not be published in Nature, but I don't know, was this one peer reviewer, was it his close friend, or was it thousand peer reviews?
You know, there is a kind of code of ethics that they won't ask for a friend to
review. But if it's not open, but it's don't know, secret. Absolutely. Yeah. So who knows?
But even what you don't, it's so there's 2 points, which is the first one, that it would be very interesting to see the reviews, be it only from a scientific point of view and not only to guarantee the openness of all that. And the second point is that publishing the reviews, well, reviewing a paper is hard work. And if, as a reviewer, you know your review won't be published, you have no incentive to do it properly because you're not paid for it, as far as I know.
Can you, for the uninformed like me, repeat this point?
So
scientific research get published in journals.
Yes.
The author of an article get paid?
No.
No. So he make it for his own career boost. Yes. So he has an indirect incentive.
Yes.
To usually he give the right then of publishment
to the journal. Yes.
And get nothing in return.
Yes.
But the whole point of a scientific journal is that not everyone can publish, only peer-reviewed research can publish, so you need an equivalent clever scientist who proofread your concept and ideally try to repeat the experiments.
Exactly,
And only if he say, this is good research, and some more peer reviewers stated, then your article get published.
Yes. And usually there's a little conversation, and you should correct this,
so he can say, So the original author get nothing from the magazine. Mm. The peer reviewers themselves, they get money or something for all this work?
I don't know if they get money or not. I haven't looked into that into enough detail yet. What I do know is they don't get any career boost from that. They
so
participate
you cannot
say,
I'm a very young doctor, I peer-reviewed 50 articles, but published none because all the time I was peer-reviewing.
No, that
so
is not valued.
It's a career stop.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Career dumper.
So it's a career dump, and there's no incentive to do it properly. So it happens quite often that papers are reviewed, but only on a small part of the paper. And so if it's in this classical field, for example, people will know that there is this very classical question to answer back. And so you read the paper quickly because you don't really have time because you're not paid for that. And you know there is this tricky question that you can always answer, and you answer that always tricky question, and you're done.
So as a practical thinking man, if I was in an institute, paid by tax money, and got this task of peer reviewing, I would give it my students.
Yeah.
Maybe I would not talk about it and have the honor for myself, because I maybe would look over what the students produce before sending it back, but maybe not, because I'm busy.
I don't know if that happens. It may happen. I don't want to devilize everybody either. But the fact...
The point is this is a closed system,
absolutely,
and we cannot. It's not transparent. It's not open.
Yeah.
It's
and if
good.
Those reviews were to be published and themselves voted up or down, Reddit comments.
So you want a
that would
a scientific
completely change
Reddit.
The ecosystem. In fact,
you want a scientific Reddit, also where the whole mechanism of voting and reviewing is open and transparent, and ideally. Yeah, it should, at least everyone should get nothing.
Yes.
Not also the magazine publisher should milk the libraries.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
universities.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the debate as to, yes, whether scientific journals still have a place at all as reading committees and selection committees. Because
they're usually not professors in the field they're reading about.
Oh, there can be. They can be. But the thing is, there is a huge production of science, and you need some mechanism to filter through, because you can't read everything. And one
this is basically
of the added
the
values
upvoting and downvoting what in Reddit happens automatically.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And the question is, but would it work for science?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit difficult to push that idea forward because, well, for one, the scientific community is very conservative.
Okay.
Which
I was
sense.
Always thinking they're on the cutting edge of human.
They're on the cutting edge of their own research,
okay,
but not
on
the current
society
for practices.
Okay.
Because
they still have no flying cars and
it's practices that haven't that have worked for a long time,
okay,
and
so
it's
conservative.
It's hard to change them. And so getting a critical mass of people to a new system is going to be very complicated. But there are more and more people interested in doing that.
And you know about initiatives who are already doing such peer review journals? I only read about one mathematical journal who want to do that.
I haven't heard of any, I don't think. There probably are, because I haven't been following that subject very closely.
I have
the
depressing feeling that before the next talk we have to start it ourselves, because no one else will do it.
But I know people who are really interested in that. I was I worked a little bit with a psychoinformatics researcher called Tal Yarkoni. He's based in University of Colorado. And him and Satrajit Ghosh, who is at MIT, are people very interested in trying to push that model of Reddit-based
so
peer
openness,
review.
Transparency for scientific
absolutely,
reviews.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the key point they identified as being a problem with previous systems that have tried to change this is the peer review publishing thing. That if you let researchers be valued for their reviewing, it will really push people to come towards that system, because it's very there's a lot more of your work that is valued, in fact, and recognized compared to other systems where that work is basically silenced.
Low battery again.
It's so weird.
Okay, it's still recording. Let's talk.
Okay.
So, what is your advice for young students? In which areas should they reading or gather information if they want to have be part of a more progressive review system and a more open science for themselves?
My advice would be get involved in the community.
Yeah.
Be it by
so in
going
the community,
to see
you
the community of people interested in that. There is there is right now, I think there is no proper solution.
Okay.
Either you really dive into that, but you're going to kill your career, or you don't at all, and well, you're kind of at a
but there's
problem
no
with
Facebook
yourself.
Group for open students, or open science students.
There are a few groups and hubs. There's a one initiative that's become very interesting that is Hack Your PhD. So there's a Facebook group that's called Hack Your PhD. It's a girl called Celia in London who's been working on basically changing her practice of her PhD and working on open science, open access, more transparency, and so for example, blogging about your research a lot more often. There is the Mozilla Science Lab, if you're interested in their initiatives, who are pushing for code reviews. There is the Open Science Initiative, I think, which have built a platform to ease the linking of papers and code and the publishing of code. Kind of GitHub for papers. And there is the Open Knowledge Foundation, who have quite a lot of resources and well connected, and have a quite large community of researchers and not only students interested in open access and generally open science. So those are all people to talk to and get in contact with and build
community.
What point
in your study career you recommend getting into that? Is it good for first year student, or should you do it when you're writing your final thesis?
I think you should do it as soon as possible because it needs to change.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's a very good advice for your career.
It
probably doesn't take that much time and doesn't hinder anything as long as you're still trying to publish your work during the with the regular means. I think it's something that has to change, that is coming from the students, and I think
because the departments are conservative, you think if change will come and push to change will come, it will come from the students and society, not from the institutions themselves.
No, definitely not. Yes. Okay. The institutions have no reason to changing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard, because mm-hmm. it's the whole community isn't working that way. And even senior researchers, a growing fraction of senior researchers are getting to awareness that there is this problem. But it's always growing more as there are more students mm. talking to them about it. And it's definitely, the change does not come from institutions or senior researchers.
Another question, if you're a researcher and not a coder, let's say mm-hmm. you make psychology, or mm-hmm. Can you recommend, you as a scientist, can you recommend that it's a good thing to, if not coding experience, at least get a bit open source experience, like how GitHub works and how to do edits, because that would maybe help even your scientific publishing?
I don't think it's always useful. I think mm-hmm. it's useful to get accustomed to the practices and the community
mm-hmm.
Behind it. I don't think that coding is always necessary.
Yep.
There's this idea that the world, that everybody should learn coding in the world.
Yeah, as a coding instructor for money, I'm ready for that idea.
Well, I don't know what my opinion is on that. I'm kind of...
I was not thinking so much at coding themselves, mm-hmm. yes? But at least how to change a README file that is published on GitHub.
Yes,
how to make a pull
request,
how these connections work, how to use the tools.
Yeah. That would be very important, be it only because some people are starting to write their papers directly on GitHub mm-hmm. in Markdown instead of LaTeX and etc. So they use the collaboration platform mm-hmm. that GitHub is, and it isn't only for code, it's also for papers.
Yeah, so you should at least get involved in using Git properly and using collaborative working, maybe Google Docs or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't even need to start looking at the command line Git. You can use GitHub without command line Git.
Interface. Yes, okay.
And that's true that it's a lot easier to work with people who already have experienced a bit of GitHub and the workflow and
could you recommend that to not coding
definitely.
Scientists?
Yes.
At least
yes,
familiar with the web-based tools that you can...
And it's very easy to get familiar with. It takes 1 hour, I'd say.
And then you think that is rewarding so that I as a scientist I can better collaborate with computer science students
Absolutely.
Or with more cool projects or more openness?
Okay. It eases conversation and collaboration generally, overall, and it helps people in understanding each other and the way they work.
Okay.
And so that's definitely very important, yes.
Well, Sebastian, thanks for this interview.
Thank you, Horst. Thank you very much. It was very instructive.
Ah, yes. You have a blog or Facebook page or Google something?
I have
Twitter
a homepage.
Account, a homepage, please.
Which
can you describe the homepage so that I can, a lot of spelling errors, I can publish it?
It is at meho.net, so MEHO.net /SL, so Sebastian Lerique, which is my name.
Okay.
It's self-hosted, so it's a bit slow. Don't be surprised if it's
and
slow.
And you publish on Twitter or some social media?
I'm on Twitter, but I read a lot. I don't publish a lot. I mm-hmm. try to publish more and more. I just started a blog, which is very empty for now, on that website, on that homepage.
Can you maybe announce your Twitter account? So
My Twitter is, and my GitHub.
And GitHub, you too?
Yes.
Okay.
Also, it's a bit of a complicated nickname. It's Whelutyk, so it's Whelutyk. So that's my Twitter handle and GitHub account.
Okay.
It's all linked from the website.
Your best project on GitHub, so if people want to look a bit?
Right now, I'm working on an Android app and Servert, and it's an experiment we're doing on about daydreaming, which has little to do with what I've talked about before, but we're trying to push science, cognitive science, to be used on smartphones. And
so you want to make smartphones smarter?
Yes, exactly, and use all the information
what
they
is
have.
And daydreaming is the search term in GitHub where I find this project.
Yes. Okay. You can look. It's on my. It's linked from my one of the organizations I'm in.
Yeah.
Is called Daydreaming Experiment, and
so
all the code is there.
So I enter daydreaming in GitHub, and I will sooner or later find you.
Yes. Okay. And so the idea behind that is. Well, if you want me to talk about it quickly, it's when we start to daydreaming in everyday life, in fact, when we disconnect of the immediate environment and start thinking of people who aren't there, the future, the past, far places, and we do that over half of our conscious time. In fact, we do that a lot. And we don't really understand why we do that all the time, what effects it has, etc. And so with a friend, we met a group of psychologists. With a friend, we were starting to work on trying to get cognitive science experiments on smartphones and tablets because they can be really outsourced in a way that you reach a lot more people and it's a lot easier to participate for everybody in those experiments. And we met this group of researchers in York who are working on daydreaming and who were very interested in using the in vivo capabilities of smartphones. So the main difference between a smartphone and a lab is that at a lab you have to ask people to come over, you have to pay them, you have to organize a schedule, and they are
a smartphone is a lab in a pocket with
exactly.
a research subject carrying
and
around
your smartphone is in your pocket all the time. So what this app does, which is impossible in a lab, it asks you questions at random
moments through the day.
Uh-huh. And
it's not in a lab or situation, in the real life.
Yeah. And from that, it also records position, your position regularly, because there is a question as, for example, if people who move a lot or who are far from their home, do they daydream more?
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't started looking at the data yet.
What does the smartphone actually ask what you are daydreaming about right now?
So there are a number of questions. It's right before the smartphone interrupted you, were you daydreaming?
Mm-hmm.
It's a scale from left to right.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of yourself? Were you thinking about other people? Were those people close or far from you emotionally?
Okay.
Were you thinking about the past, about the future, far past, far future?
So this is a bit psychological research.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what were you doing when you were interrupted?
Wow, I mean, this should especially be a cool app for all the students worldwide who's sitting bored in a lecture.
It definitely is. It is. You
they can put tons of research data accumulated.
So we're still in the testing phase right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested, so the questions are still being iterated over, and we're changing them a little bit. If you're interested in having a look at what it looks like, there's a website. It's daydreaming-the-app.net.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can Google it. We're not very linked towards. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's linked via GitHub daydreaming project.
Yes.
In the beginning.
Yes.
Okay.
And so right now you can download the app. It should work pretty much on every device.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not too much of the
old ones.
And
the research data I enter in this daydreaming app, yes?
Yes.
This will make Nature magazine richer, or will it...
we don't know yet. It could.
Okay.
It could, but we don't
know
yet.
So you don't even know if it will be open research.
Publishing that data is... We could publish... I don't know what the practices are in that field. The problem with that data, it's personal. So we...
You must anonymize
it
first.
Well, we don't have any user names or anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've been very careful at only trying to gather anonymized data and identifiers. But the problem is we have positions of the people. So that's very
identifying. As a teacher could see, one student in my class was daydreaming about having sex with me.
Well, you can't you can't know that it's your student because you'd have to analyze the data.
If I have a class of one student, the probability is very high.
But you have to know the movement patterns of your student to find him in the data, because he's only a number in the data. He's not So that's the main problem that there would be in publishing that data. I would be very interested in publishing it and trying to
but
get other people
to
use it.
Privacy
but
issues.
Yes,
okay.
There is a big privacy question.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
hope you get a lot of followers on Twitter.
I hope so too.
Okay. Ciao. So, look, I see.